Time Blong Master, the Australian involvement with Papua New Guinea.
On Sunday, they go down into the creek and the river and have a good wash, and you generally give them a cake of soap, and then they put this white lap on and then a frangipani in their hair and give them a mark, which is a shilling, and away they go, and hundreds of them go. And I'll tell you why they go to church, because after church they give them a nice feed of all sorts of cakes and biscuits and lolly water, that is lemonade, because no beer. But to drive past and hear them singing, it's really beautiful.
I came up very anti-missionary. I thought, what right had we? Most of us do that. What right had we to go and change people's beliefs? And it's awful of us, really. But golly, you've only got to work round and see the way the missionaries live and the self-sacrifice of their lives and the way they're respected by the local people. And the reason they're respected so much is because they nearly all speak not Motu, which government people would do, but the place language of the district. And also, they were often in the same area for 20 years or 25 years, and so they were part of the scene. The other thing that I've always observed about missionaries, it doesn't matter what denomination, they're happy, sparkling-eyed, people with a gorgeous sense of humour, and there was remarkably little dissension between the ecumenical spirit was very active in Papua New Guinea long before Pope John.
For many Papua New Guineans, their first contact with Europeans was with the missionaries, who often established their stations in remote areas of the country well before any Australian government presence. While the existence of so many unsaved souls was an irresistible lure to the major Christian churches, all were quickly involved in general educational and medical work. In practical terms, the missions were an indispensable arm of the Australian presence. In The Good News, the first of two programs on missionary work in Papua New Guinea, we'll look at the work of the early missionaries. Dr. Hank Nelson.
When the new nation of Papua New Guinea adopted its constitution in 1975, the people pledged themselves to guard and pass on our noble traditions and the Christian principles that are ours now. 100 years of work by Christian missionaries had a profound effect. But the early attempts to make converts were not successful. In the 1840s, Catholic missionaries went to the islands of Woodlark and Umboy. They laboured for 8 years through malaria, semi-starvation and rejection before they finally left the islands and the graves of their colleagues. In 1872, the London Missionary Society settled South Sea Island Christians on the south coast, and in 1874, the Reverend William Laws built his station in Port Moresby. The next year, the Methodists began work in the New Guinea Islands. Permanent mission work had begun 10 years before either the British or the Germans set up their governments. By 1890, the major Protestant missions in Papua had defined their spheres of influence. The government enforced their separation by the neat device of not letting a mission take up land outside its own sphere.
This policy was known as the Committee of Missions. It didn't extend really to the New Guinea side as contrasted with the Papuan side. It was the very intelligent first great lieutenant governor of Papua, Sir William MacGregor, who asked the principal Christian missions to divide the country and have different spheres of influence. At that stage, I think this was a very good thing, because it would only have confused the people to have had everybody running in, as it has done in other parts of the country.
The plan which was worked out was that the LMS would work the whole of the southern coastline of Papua from what was then the Dutch border in the west to Samurai in the east, and inland from this coastline. The Anglicans were to work from Samurai up the northeast coast and inland from there. There was a good hefty range of mountains in the middle to prevent us from running into one another. The Methodist mission was to work the groups of islands off the southeastern end of Papua. Now that worked very, very well for a very large number of years.
In 1901, the Reverend James Chalmers, the Reverend Oliver Tompkins, 9 Papuan mission students and 2 other men went ashore on Goaraberry Island in the Papuan Gulf. They were killed and eaten. Government officers in punitive raids then shot many Goaraberry. 3 years after Chalmers was killed, a young Englishman, the Reverend Ben Butcher, arrived to take over the LMS station at Daru. His colleagues advised him not to go into the Goaraberry area, and Sir Hubert Murray warned him, "Those Goaraberry men are as wild as hawks."
But Butcher was determined to go. He got his chance when he met a Goaraberry man who'd been away to work on a plantation. The man was stranded. To get home, he had to travel across the land and water of enemy peoples.
Well, that was just the introduction I wanted. So I got him on my boat and we sailed away to the west and we felt our way in unmarked waterways and got round towards Goaraberry. Well, as we got round, canoes began to put off from different villages until we was followed by a tremendous crowd of shouting men who were all armed with their bows and their arrows, because those were in the primitive days, and they were shouting with excitement. And so I made my way past Opima, where Chalmers was killed, to where this man had his home, and there we anchored. I couldn't get near because it was very shallow water off the village, so I went ashore in one of their canoes. There was great excitement. It was my first contact with these people, but having brought back a man they had thought was dead gave me an introduction. So I was able to get amongst them and be welcomed. And while I was there, they made a presentation to me. I wondered just what was happening, because as we went ashore, the men had collared me and they collared the one boy who was with me, and they were shouting something, but we, of course, didn't know their language. And we could make out one or two words which were like words in the further west, and among the words was epia, which meant kill, and we were thinking that we might be killed when we got ashore. But when we got ashore and was taken up to the big house, crowded with men and full of the place was full of excitement, we saw a dead pig lying there, and I knew then that the killing referred to the pig and not to us. And the pig was presented to us as a gift, a token of thanksgiving for bringing back their man, and we had quite a great time before I returned to my boat. But that was how I first made contact with those people.
The Roman Catholic Church went to Papua New Guinea with faith but little material support. Unlike some Protestant missionaries who gave perhaps 7 years of their careers in the church to the missionary field, most Catholics, especially the nuns, went for life. The early Catholics had a hard time getting established in the Yule Island area in the Gulf of Papua, as Sister Mary Martha Kettle recalls.
Our mission was started. They came across from Thursday Island to Yule Island in an open boat at the beginning, and very, very hard beginnings, because they weren't supposed to be there, the Catholic missionaries. They were sent back and they came back in an open boat again, a bit of a small schooner, and settled themselves in there. And they were orphaned down to Starvation Point. The sisters came a few years later, 4 first sisters. 3 of them are buried in New Ireland. The first members of our congregation was just established actually in France, and they came out there, and very often they were reduced. One of them said that they had sago, kind of porridge for breakfast, and sago's pancakes for dinner, and sago balls for tea. And in the end, they were given a choice. If they wanted to go back to Thursday Island, they were free to do so. And they said no, and they went inland. Got inland into the Mekeo up the river. I remember the sister saying, they were bereft of everything. They've had mosquito net, nothing. They had no idea to what they were coming. But they just hung on, you know, kept on going. And from spread out through Mekeo, many of them died with blackwater fever mostly. No protection of mosquito nets, no medicine and drugs that we have now. But they've stuck out, and now we've spread out everywhere through the Mekeo.
across from Aitipi, we had a reef with a number of islands on it. The biggest island was Tumlio. The others were Celio, Ali, and Angle. On the island of Tumlio, six sisters had been brought over and dropped there. They had been there for quite some considerable time when I went to Aitipi, and that was at the beginning of 1937. They ran a native hospital, and they lived entirely on their own and relied on supplies dropped off by the shipping which came through at 3 or 4 monthly intervals. I found out that these women were there. I was quite oblivious of it at first, and I would have given anything to talk to the sisters. I never managed, in 2 years, I never managed to get over there. They were never taken from their island. They were left there, and I imagine they stayed there until they died, because this is what happened with most of the missions in the case of women. I felt that while I had a lot of feeling for the mission and felt that they were doing a tremendous job, I felt, in a way, angry about the future of the people who were working so hard there, because I found that these nuns came from Germany at the age of 18 and never went home again, had no hope of getting out of New Guinea. In other words, they were there for life.
The Reverend and Mrs. Eric Ewer ran the LMS mission on Daru pre-war, and like missionaries everywhere in Papua New Guinea, learned to make the best of what they had. Among other things, the mission house was expected to be a centre for the dissemination of domestic arts.
I didn't need a cookbook from one of the stores to take with me. What I needed was something extraordinary. I needed to know how to cook seabird's eggs and turtle's eggs and dugong and turtle and bush pig and such things. And there weren't any books to tell me any of these things. Fortunately, there was a woman on the station, the wife of the head pastor. Her name was Maggie. She was a marvellous person. She had been cook girl to James Chalmers when he was there and lived in the house in which we lived in eventually. And Maggie was wonderful. She taught me how to take the mud crabs and boil them and take the meat out and those nice red shells and all the lovely things that you could mix up together and turn into really a very attractive dish to put on the table. She taught me how to cook dugong. It needed an awful lot of boiling. It was better to be minced, unless it was a very young one. The turtle meat was strange. At first, it looked like veal. And when you went to cut it, it jumped. The nerves were all still alive. And you put it in a pan, and likely as not, a piece would hop right out. And by the time it was cooked, it was white like a veal and was a most attractive dish. The people coming past Bramble Cay on their way to Daru in their boats would sometimes bring buckets of seabird eggs and turtle eggs. Turtle eggs were the best. They really didn't taste fishy. But the others, you had to put an awful lot of vanilla in a cake if you wanted to use a seabird's egg to cook cakes with. I tried to set jelly while we were out there. I was just longing for a bit of jelly. Of course, we had no refrigerators, no radio. I was told that if you set it overnight, but who wants jelly for breakfast? I did try, and it did get just a little bit coagulated, but that was all.
We lived fairly well at Ogura. We maintained a certain formality for meals. The menu wasn't always luxurious or anything like that. Sometimes we're far from it. But we maintained a standard. We tried to for meals and for entertaining when we had visitors. Clean tablecloths, table napkins, and nicely polished silver, which was old and battered generally, and so was the china. But we always tried to maintain that standard. It wasn't always easy. It was nearly all tinned meat in those days, unless you got a bit of fresh fish, a certain number of tinned vegetables. Apart from that, a rather monotonous diet of sweet potatoes and pumpkin and greens, which were generally pumpkin tips or something like that, sweet potato tips. In pre-war days, we generally changed into nice frocks and no black tie or anything like that, but we generally changed into something fresh. We had domestic staff, which was sometimes trained and was sometimes not, which had to be trained. We did all we could ourselves, as much as possible ourselves. in training the children, the girls and boys, to keep a nice outlook on domestic life.
The welfare services provided by the missions were certainly appreciated by the Australian government. Former Assistant Administrator Sir John Gunther.
I would think that they did at least 15% of all the medical work that was done, at least. Probably more, it's hard to measure. At one stage, of course, they did nearly all of the education. Well, pre-war, they did do all of the education in Papua and most of it in New Guinea.
We weren't giving any education at all until the outbreak of war. You know, there were only two government schools in the whole territory and 2 million people, because they had a policy then that education be handed over to the missions, and they were subsidised to that effect.
Unless you taught them to write, they were stuck, and you could never get them very far. But writing, of course, was a very difficult thing to teach them, because they had no idea whatever of letters. Though they drew their crude pictures, the idea of a letter had no meaning at all. When I was first amongst them, I would be sitting there, say, in the great house, close by where the skulls were hanging, because that was the place I could get the best light. And there I'd sit, and as I talked to them, I would jot down words written in their language, but using phonetic spelling. And they'd wonder what I was doing. They'd see me, I'd be talking to them, and I'd suddenly start writing something, and they couldn't make it out. Then they'd come and look over my shoulder, and all they'd see would be a lot of what seemed to them queer markings, but nothing else. And then I one day saw the whole thing dawn on them, and it changed things tremendously for them and for me. I was building a house on my station, and some of these wild fellows came in to see what we were doing, and they were wandering round, and I wanted a tool that was up at my house on the hill. So I picked up a slither of wood that one of my helpers had just edged off a log, and then with my carpenter's pencil I wrote on it what I wanted, and I called one of these men who had come in and was looking around. I called him and I told him to take it up to my wife and he would tell her what I want and he could bring it. Well, he looked at this piece of wood and then he looked at me as if I were making a fool of him. I had a job in explaining. I was quite serious, and if he did what I told him, that's what would happen. Very reluctantly he started up the hill, and all his fellows were sniggering, his companions, they were sniggering and laughing. It looked so silly for a big man to be carrying a little piece of wood up the hill, which any of them would have thrown on the fire. Then after a while I saw him coming down. He'd gone up very slowly, but now he was coming down in leaps. Down the hill he came. He had the tool in his hand. He gave it to me, and then he rushed off with a piece of wood that he had still held, and he showed it to them. Look, he said, look what this man has done. He took this piece of wood and he made it talk, and I took it up the hill and it talked. Now that was the first realization they had of what writing might mean, making things talk. And from that on, we went on. And so little by little, they began to see the wonder of the written word, until I was able to start translating the Gospels. And then they could read and read themselves what I had written. But before ever they did that, they'd started something else which amused me and interested me. They began to write little letters to each other. And so this amazing gift of the written word came to those primitive people.
In those days, the early education we were given was mostly on church or Christian-type education. It was a very, very little mathematics and English teaching, but was mainly Bible and hymn singing and Bible reading and some drawing of pictures of early Christians and all about Bible people who are in Bible stories. The teachers who were teaching us were not qualified teachers with certificates, but they were just village pastors or missionaries who have no formal education in those days. Until I went to Irubara school, then we were taught English and mathematics. That was early 1960s. I am very critical of the policies. Even today, there are a number of churches or Christian groups in the country, and they are more or less having a competition with the government type of education. Why I'm critical is that because their teaching is based on a Christian, not trying to advance the people to get more and better education for them to devote their time into government working for the community, but influencing people who are members of the Christian church they belong to remain with the church and do various jobs for the church.
The mission schools were really of two types. There were schools whose primary purpose was teaching religious dogma and so on. And then there were schools which operated on the standard curriculum as the government schools were doing. The religious schools operated principally in the local vernacular, sometimes entirely so. And the state schools adhered to the curriculum and operated mostly in English. We wouldn't subsidise the religious schools, but we did subsidise the state schools. And because we insisted on English at that particular time, we had arguments with a few of the mission groups who thought it would be better to teach in the vernacular. In a sense, that may have been right, but assuming there was a conversion to English later on. But at the time, there were so many different languages, and still are, of course, that the production of written material in a large number of different languages seemed an impossible task to us. So I think with some justification we thought English should be the general medium. There were, of course, some difficult examples of mission policies in teaching language in schools. For instance, one missionary group, originally established on the New Guinea coast, became fluent in the language of that area, had the Bible translated into that language, had textbooks printed in that language, and then when they moved into other areas, they imported this foreign vernacular language of that particular area. Now, this seemed to us to be highly undesirable. It was accomplishing nothing at all, as far as we could see, except obstructing further development of language skills. So we had an argument with the mission on this particular policy of theirs.
We started learning English, and the way we learned English was that they would put up items like banana, taro, sago, parts of the body, and so on. And then beside it, they would write the English names for that. And, you know, we had terrible difficulty in pronouncing these English words, absolutely difficult. So, you know, at times, if we didn't learn properly, then the teacher would sort of, I mean, this is not the European teacher, but the indigenous teachers, you know, evangelists, basically, would sort of really punish us, sort of to sit on the chair or pull our ear or bash our heads against something else or, you know, all sorts of things. I remember one occasion when I didn't comb my hair because I was late for school. I got up late from sleep and I had my wash and the bell went. So I came to the classroom without combing my hair. And this teacher got up and said, well, why haven't you combed your hair? So he really got me and bashed my head against the wall. In other words, this was a sort of way in which they said that they were teaching us, you know, hygiene and smartness and all these kind of rules.
When John Wacker went to the Anglican Church's Martyr School in Papua's northern district, the ear-pulling and head-bashing ended. And he was particularly impressed by the behaviour and attitude of one Australian woman missionary teacher to her Papuan pupils.
We would go at night into her house and just look at the pictures, talk to her and play with other things, you know. And she would just let us do it, so long as it's before 9 o'clock. So I began to form a slightly different picture of the missionary, really, at the time. And I think this particular person, this particular lady, I think was quite different. And I still think she's quite different. She was sort of like a mother, you know, sort of made me feel a bit easy, a bit warm, you know. So I began to form my own opinion about different groups of people.
I taught them to read and to write, to do simple arithmetic. Hygiene, they came straight in from the village. I sent them down the first thing. They wore a leaf in their armband that had a very strong smell, and after all, when there were about 50 or 60 of them in a fairly small room, and it's very hot, you can quite imagine what it was like. So first time I sent them down to have a swim, that was my first lesson in hygiene, and getting rid of this smelly thing that they were wearing. They did a lot of dancing at night, and goodness knows what went on there. And sometimes they'd come in with their faces painted. Well, I'd try and get them to clean it off, if it was objectionable, but not otherwise, it didn't matter much. We tried to teach them what we might have called ethics and morals and that type of thing. And well, you're often being told that the early missionaries cut down all their customs, but that isn't true. If they were doing pagan things beforehand, when they became Christian, they didn't want to do them. But we never at any time said, that's wrong, don't do that. We left them to find out for themselves. That's in their own way. If they broke any other rules, like fighting and bashing somebody up, that was different, of course. We used to have to adjudicate a little bit about that, because the government officer was only a patrol leader at that time, and he was about 40 miles away along the coast. Some of our people had been cannibals, I suppose. But then I don't think anyone said to them, you're not to do that. I think that was the same idea. They came out under the early missionaries and learnt how to be a Christian, how to love the Lord, and they no longer wanted to do that kind of thing that they'd done. Although some of the old people on our station still remembered when they used to be allowed to have a little drink of the blood of the person that they'd brought in. And those were the people, when they first became Christianized, they were the ones that were sent out to preach the gospel to the people that they had only a few years before fought with.
There was always tension about the extent and nature of missionary involvement in education. Some missionaries thought the school should be just a means to save souls. The students should be taught reading only because that was a way for them to learn more about Christ. But that was less than many Papua New Guineans expected. Other missionaries were prepared to invest their meagre funds in technical schools and higher education. They accepted responsibility for transforming an entire culture and providing opportunities for Papua New Guineans to advance in the world beyond the village. Ironically, those Papua New Guineans who have been the most effective critics of the missions were trained by the missions. There has been less argument about medical work. The missions had a long tradition of caring for the body as well as the soul. The long hours and the effective work of the medical missionaries also had the practical benefit of winning support from local communities.
Well, as a matter of fact, it was a Mrs. Haywood who was talking at a missionary meeting, telling us that missionaries were needed in the islands. And she asked and said, I hope there's somebody here who will answer the call. And I, quite unconsciously, though I wasn't at the time a Christian, I said I would go. And I must have said it aloud, because my mother just gave me a stare, as if to say, fancy you going to be a missionary. But as soon as I became a Christian, the first thing that came to my mind again was, you promised the Lord to be a missionary. And I was cleaning the bath at home at the time, and I felt I had to go and write a letter to a friend to ask her how I could apply. I wrote the letter, and from there I didn't hesitate. I got an invitation to go to the mission office. There they made inquiries as to what I would be willing to do, either become a teacher or a nurse. So I went in for nursing. And fortunately, I loved the nursing right from the start. We used to go periodically to do a medical inspection. And we generally took a nurse by the name of Eleanor, and a boy, Bill, Willie. We called him Willie, a medical boy. And then we had three or four who would carry our gear for us. And our travel wasn't by motor or bike or anything, or horse or anything else. It was by foot. And most of our roads were tracks, just tracks too. And we used to have to cross rivers. Sometimes we just went in a canoe, a native canoe. I remember going to one village and nobody was there. And I had a little hand gramophone, and so I put the gramophone on, and in no time they were all crowded around the gramophone. So I was able to give injections and quinine, and so I was able to treat them there because of the gramophone. One case, we had a man who was mauled by a wild pig, and we put 23 stitches in him. He was a very brave man too, because my anaesthetist wasn't there, so I had to give it to him without an anaesthetic, and he stood it all. Another time, we had a man come in who'd been mauled by a pig, and his intestines were all outside, and nothing could be done for him because he came in the middle of the night and we had no boat at the time to send him into a doctor. So unfortunately we lost him. We had an epidemic of influenza on the station and at the hospital. This epidemic raged through us all, and there was just two of us nurses or sisters in charge. And we're working day and night. We'd been working like this for about a week, and we'd neither of us taken our clothes off our backs. And one night, our cook had come over to us at 8:30 to tell us our dinner was ready. We went over, we just pulled our chairs out to sit and have our dinner, when one of the nurses came over to us to tell us that one of our babies was taking fits. So we rushed back to the hospital, and we were with that baby till after 1 o'clock in the morning. We came back, both of us, and we just looked at one another. When we were there at 8:30, we just felt we couldn't go another second. But when we came back at 1 o'clock in the morning, we both felt so refreshed. And my partner said to me, "Somebody at home is praying for us." And we did at that hour. We felt so refreshed, and yet at 8:30 we just felt we couldn't go any further.
One of the most persistent criticisms of missionary activity in Papua New Guinea is that Christianity was imposed on the people, with some missionaries actively suppressing or even destroying the indigenous culture.
On the LMS side, there was the difficulty that our earliest pastors were from the South Seas, from the Cook Islands, Samoa, and so on. These Polynesians regarded themselves as very much a superior race vis-a-vis the Papuans, and some of them were of chiefly rank, which meant quite a lot in their home islands.
I have seen, like we call Kovave, Erawo. Erawo are these longhouses. Kovave is the mosque that people initiated on, you know, going. They were, and also Hohau, the big board. Those boards were physically destroyed, but they were sacred to our people, very sacred. They were burned, they were broken, but all this was not done by European missionaries. All were done Pacific Islanders, mainly Samoans. Samoans were the worst ones. I mean, they discouraged our people on these heathen things. I was angry because my people were angry, so I was angry. But what can you do when you've been challenged by somebody whose beliefs is different? But now, you know, after so many years and looking back, I feel sorry that all that has been destroyed.
Christianity are the people who have destroyed, actually destroyed, most of our good cultures, which could be living today, but is dead because they told us that is rude, that is no good, that's against God and all that crap.
A lot of things have been taken from us, and they are now in Europe. We'd like to get a carbon copies, and we want to be able to do something similar and send it back, and we can keep the old ones because, you know, traditionally we believe they are our rites, they are our rituals, and nobody should deprive us from our rituals. The missionaries consider them to be bad. Instead of being bad, they put them in the stores, package them, send them to Brussels, to Munich, they send them everywhere. maybe to British Museum and Museum of Primitive Art in New York. They've taken a lot of our stuff. And of course, they have the scientists, anthropologists, sociologists who study about our culture. What about our future generation? How would they study their own culture when we are being deprived of our own things?
I don't think that the early pioneers upset too much of the native customs. There were some of the things that were abhorrent, mostly associated with sex and so on. And so some of the dances that led on to sex were frowned on by the missionary bodies, but dancing as such was never forbidden.
And the particular religion that came was a Victorian interpretation of Christianity, so it was rather a pathetic philosophy to get through life anyway. However, those missionaries, all praise to them, were the idealists and reformers of their times, and they were victims of their times, and they gave their lives to what they saw was the right thing for them to do. And the majority of them, I'm thinking of the London Missionary Society in Papua, if one could say all the London Missionary Society people, were very gentle people. I've heard examples of violence by missionaries, but I don't think it was in this area. For one thing, they were so few on the field and they had so little resources.
I never treated their religious ideas with even a smile. I reckon that these were sacred things for them and very real, and I treated them as that. And it was often their beliefs that helped me to start and give them something still further. I remember sitting on one of their great houses, and there was a figure of Iriwaki above my head. Iriwaki, one of the great ancestral spirits. Iriwaki was a great warrior, and always there at the entrance of the great house was his figure, with a bone dagger in its belt and bow and arrow and things like that. But Iriwaki was the god of war, and yet he was more than that. I remember sitting and asking the people things about him, and I said, do you know anybody who belonged to Iriwaki? Oh, yes, they said. There's Iriwaki, that's his brother. Ah. Well, I said, what about his father? And I was amazed when they said, oh, but we don't know his father. We'd never heard of him. Iriwaki, Iriwaki, yes. Never heard of his father. Ah, well, I said, I know his father. That immediately intrigued them, that I should know someone related to their Iriwaki and Iriwaki. So I began to talk of God. And once God became real to them, and I was able to go on from there. And it was in those ways that one linked what you believed with what they believed, and it helped tremendously.
The missionaries came to change beliefs, and much Papua New Guinean art, as elsewhere, was associated with matters of the spirit. When the missionaries changed one, they inevitably affected the other. But other foreigners also aimed to destroy parts of the old cultures. Recruiters, merchants, and government officers were agents of change. Nor were the Papua New Guineans just sitting in the villages waiting to be acted upon. They were as eager to go and meet the outside world as other villages in Ireland or Italy. But the missionaries were the most obvious, because they preached the need for change, and some of them, in moments of zealousness, burnt irreplaceable objects of Melanesian art. It's also true that missionaries who spent up to 30 years among a particular community acquired more knowledge and respect for another culture than any other foreigners. In a strange twist, some missionaries have become the guardians of old village values against what they see as a brash secular modernism. There is no simple answer if you ask, would it have been better had the missionaries stayed at home?
That's one of the oldest ones that people throw up against the Christian mission. But of course, it's not only, if you're going to throw it up at all, it's not only against the Christian mission, but against the whole presence of, well, if you like, the colonial power and the whole lot. But the fact is that a country can't remain wrapped up in cotton wool and isolated from the rest of the world. Otherwise, somebody will come and just swallow it up and make all its citizens hewers of wood and drawers of water. Might have happened to us if the Japanese had won the war. But the fact is that a country has got to come out into the world, got to sink or swim. And those of us who have come here, certainly I think in the Christian mission, have seen our work also as an attempt to help people not to sink but to swim. And the noble savage, all right, but if anybody who makes that jibe against our people would really try to get inside the people's minds and see how much of traditional life and society was ruled by sheer fear of upsetting the spirits of the ancestors, sheer fear of sorcery and witchcraft, sheer fear of evil spirits which can cause sickness and death, vendettas, paybacks, revenge, fighting. Oh, the whole thing just falls to the ground.
But after a lifetime's missionary work in Papua for the LMS, Ben Butcher, interviewed in his 95th year, was not quite so confident.
I've asked myself that. I wonder. I think their life was better then than it is now with the vast evils that have been introduced. Though I don't know. It's so difficult to say which is the better or what would have happened. The fighting that was always there, and yet the fighting was under control. They'd have always gone on fighting, I suppose. They'd have always had their promiscuous intercourse, but they wouldn't have had their drinking. I don't know. It's very hard. You can't say that it would have been better or worse. Who knows? You don't know how much they would have advanced if we hadn't been among them. You know how far they've gone back in some ways since we've been amongst them. I remember I was in a village in Papua, a lovely, lovely little place in my part of the country. I'd gone in to have a talk with the people. I was sitting in the great house, and the men gathered round and the women came in. I think there were only one or two children. Oh, I said, I want to see the children too here. I'd like to see them. Oh, they said, there aren't any children. I said, what? No, they said, there were no children now. And here was a village that was depopulated by our introduced disease. It was a terrible thing. It came as a shock. I spoke to the governor about it. And he was so impressed that he sent doctors from Port Moresby to see what could be done. And they've gradually brought it under some control. But that was how it happened. And that's what I saw with my own eyes. Now, I don't know. You say, what? Would they have been better without us? I don't know.
In The Good News, you heard the voices of Gladys Stevens, Dame Rachel Cleland, Archbishop David Hand, the Reverend Percy Chatterton, the Reverend Ben Butcher, Sister Mary Martha Kettle, Teresa Bloxham, the Reverend and Mrs. Eric Ewer, Marva Keckwick, Sir John Gunther, Sir Horace Nile, Wynne Herry, Les Johnson, John Wyko, Olive Dixon, Hetty Warner, Samari Kiki, Stephen Takaku, Michael Samari, and John Collier. Comment was by Dr. Hank Nelson, Fellow in the Department of Pacific and Southeast Asian History at the Australian National University.